Claims of giant bones being found in North America are not uncommon. Well, they weren't uncommon 150 years ago, at least not from the scientific community. But nowadays, the only people that really talk about that stuff are fringe nutters like myself. But the fact of the matter is, as 150 years ago, even 100 years ago, it seems like every time they would turn a spade in a Native American mound in North America, they would find a skeleton that was 6 foot 5 inches, 6 foot 10 inches, 7 foot, even 8 feet tall were reported at times. And this has led to the accusations of a cover-up by the Smithsonian Institute, since a lot of those bones were sent there, and the Smithsonian Institute later debunked the whole idea of this being a thing. So let's take a gander at this. Is there a cover-up? Is there not a cover-up? What the hell's going on here? Because as usual, it seems we have people that have a dog in the fight on both sides, so can't trust anybody. So let's take a look. Hi, my name is Dan, and welcome to the Dunking. Now, I imagine most of you watching me have heard of this stuff before. I mean, even Abraham Lincoln talked about this. The eyes of that species of extinct giants, whose bones fill the mounds of America, have gazed on Niagara, as ours do now. So I'm not going to delve into every case of giants being reported in the Americas. I mean, we know some of these were hoaxes. You know, the Cardiff giant, for example, was a hoax, and P.T. Barnum's copycat was a hoax. So at least a few of them had to be hoaxes. So what I've done is pick the ones that have the most intriguing evidence for them. So let's get started in West Virginia. In the case of the Smith Mound near Charleston, we have the following report. At this depth in his downward progress, Colonel Norris began to encounter the remains of what further excavation showed to have been a timber vault, about 12 feet square and 7 or 8 feet high. In this vault were found five skeletons, one lying prostrate on the floor at a depth of 19 feet from the top of the mound, and four others which, from the positions in which they were found, were supposed to have been placed standing in the four corners. The skeleton found lying in the middle of the floor of the vault was of unusually large size, measuring 7 foot 6 inches in length and 19 inches between the shoulder sockets. It had also been enclosed in a wrapping or coffin of bark, remains of which were still distinctly visible. It lay upon the back, head east, legs together, and arms by the sides. There were six heavy bracelets on each of the wrists. Four others were found under the head, which, together with the spear point of black flint, were encased in a mass of mortar-like substance, which had evidently been wrapped in some sort of textile fabric. On the breast was a copper gorget. Now, the man doing the field work here was a war hero by the name of Colonel P.W. Norris. And when I say war hero, I mean Civil War hero, combat veteran, spy who served on the south side of the war, and I don't mean served the south, I mean served on the south side as a spy for the north. He was a general badass, all right? He's a larger-than-life character, history records him as. And he was no amateur archaeologist. He was hired to do these excavations by the Smithsonian Institute. Now, it is fair to mention that the field of archaeology was still very new, but this man was meticulous and hired by the Smithsonian to excavate more than one mound. So I don't think it's an accident that he measured from shoulder socket to shoulder socket, where he got 19 inches and 16 is the average for modern humans, which are supposed to be larger than people were back in those days. And this is not the only skeletons that were in the mound, right? He mentions four other ones. All of those skeletons, well, they weren't mentioned to have been of abnormal size. So it wasn't like he was just going around throwing this about willy-nilly. And he mentions this again in another mound in West Virginia, simply called Mound Number 7. He claims to have found a 7-foot-tall skeleton that was rotten. Now, it's important to note that this man, Philetus Walter Norris, was considered to be a man of exceptional honesty in his day. His work for the Smithsonian is regarded as some of the most detailed and trustworthy of that time. He also went to work at Yellowstone National Park, and his efforts there made him so well-loved that the Yellowstone page gushes about him still today. Now, out of all the people that claim to have found giant bones in mounds, he ranks among the most trustworthy. Compare him, for example, to the next guy we'll talk about, John Emmerich. And John Emmerich claimed to have found giant bones in Roane County on Long Island in Tennessee, not in New York. The length of the base of the skull to the bones of the toes was found to be 7 foot 3 inches. It is probable, therefore, that this individual, when living, was fully 7.5 foot high. Now, this man is remembered quite a bit differently than Colonel Norris is. As a matter of fact, he was Colonel Norris's replacement. Norris died in 1885, and that's when Emmerich took the job. You know, Norris was, like I said, he was a larger-than-life character. He wore buckskin, and he wrote poetry, and he was a dedicated public servant and a war hero and a spy. The man was, like, larger than life. And so Emmerich had some shoes to fill, okay? And, well, he was not remotely cut from the same cloth as Norris was. The head of the Smithsonian's Mound Exploration Division, Cyrus Thomas, who we will discuss more down the road, had this to say about Emmerich in private correspondence to another Smithsonian agent. "There is no doubt Mr. Emmerich has done and can do good work at exploring mounds, though he is an uneducated man. He worked for me for 2 or 3 years, but was dropped on account of drunkenness, though he claims now to have reformed. He is the same man, as records show, who wrote to President Cleveland accusing all members of the Bureau of Geological Survey of being Republicans while he, Emmerich, was a good Democrat, having fought on the side of the rebellion." Of course, politics is going to rear its head. Why wouldn't it? But one of the big problems with Emmerich, when they say he was a drunk, apparently he would have to be drugged to his bed by his colleagues and would be put in bed with his muddy boots on, which they considered such a faux pas that, like, you'd think that it was like they were traveling to an island or something, because they talk about this man with his muddy boots in his bed like this was just like the worst thing that could ever happen to a person. Now, Emmerich had also found the Back Creek Stone, a stone that today is assumed to be a hoax, but the story is pretty odd. Basically, he found a stone that had what he claimed to be Cherokee writing on it. His boss, Cyrus Thomas, agreed, and the stone was archived in the Smithsonian. Now, in the late 1960s, it was discovered that the writing much more strongly resembles Paleo-Hebrew, and as a result, the stone was now considered to be a hoax because it got picked up on by weirdos like us that think there was contact between the Old and New World before it's generally accepted to have happened. So this thing now is considered to be trash and garbage, and what, you know, that's really neither here nor there. My point here is that there are some Smithsonian field agents that were considered untrustworthy. Even now that they look back on it, they're like, I don't know, maybe this guy's untrustworthy. But it's also important to note that the things I'm telling you were in the Smithsonian's ethnology report, their annual ethnology report in 1895 talked about these giant bones. So Cyrus Thomas, the aforementioned head of the Department of Ethnology, he was signing off on these things, okay? And Cyrus Thomas was not a slouch either, as we'll talk about shortly. But there was other bones that, you know, sometimes they would disintegrate when touched, right? And that's kind of something that normally you wouldn't want to talk about. But it is an actual issue, right? We know this now, but back in the day, we didn't really know that you could take bones out of the grave and they would just fall apart. We didn't understand it. Now we've got a pretty good way of taking care of that. But we do end up with reports like this. "One of the largest skeletons discovered by the Bureau agents, the length is proved by actual measurement between 7 and 8 feet. It was all clearly traceable, but crumbled to pieces immediately after removal from the hard earth in which it was encased." This excavation was performed by William Baker Nickerson, who was one of the best archaeologists of his time, considered to be one of the most trustworthy, one of the most scientific, and one of the most advancing in the field, however you want to say that. One of his contemporaries said of him, "A cursory examination of his notes, plans, and final report was enough to convince us that he was a most careful worker, almost too careful, and very scientific. His method of digging mounds was modern, as was all of his work. Reported by the Smithsonian to be 7 to 8 feet tall by an archaeologist who is, generally speaking, one of the best of the time." And so I could go off about a whole bunch more examples here, but I think we've got enough here to see that there are people that are bad faith actors, but there also are people who have more to lose than to gain by lying about giant bones. I mean, a guy who's already a war hero, what does he have to gain by lying about a skeleton? A guy who is a very hardcore scientist and who's really pushing hard for scientific methodology to be accurate and to go forward in the field of archaeology, what does he have to gain by lying about a skeleton? And how much of a mistake would he have to make for it to be 7 to 8 feet tall? A guy who was fired and rehired for drunkenness, yeah, you know, that guy might be lying about things. He might feel the pressure to fill the shoes of the guy before him and to do the very best that he can to make sure that he's finding some really good shit. But people who already have unimpeachable reputations have no reason to impeach themselves. And so that makes you wonder, what happened? Why is it that all of a sudden we just kind of see a switch and they no longer found giant bones anymore? Well, there's a couple of personalities. First I'll mention is Cyrus Thomas, who we've talked about a minute before already. Now, he was the head of the Smithsonian's Mound Exploration Division, as I previously said, and he initially believed that the mounds were the work of an advanced race that had since been lost. Now, eventually he changed his position to believe that the Native Americans had built the mounds, and ironically, he cited that Bat Creek stone that they now call a hoax as evidence for this. At any rate, he was in charge when the Smithsonian's ethnology reports were published, and he was considered to be a brilliant man. A lot of the work that he did in his day that made him famous was in entomology, which is bug science, for those of you who don't know any better. And he was really good and groundbreaking at stopping the spread of certain problematic plagues and pests, right? So he was a pretty smart dude, but he was also a very smart archaeologist. And, well, he had no problem signing off on this stuff for a while, but slowly, over time, he just kind of quit mentioning it. His opposition wasn't a vocal one. It was basically one of omission. He just quit talking about it. But the next guy, he didn't just quit talking about it. His name, I always pronounce right, is Ailes Hydrilicka. Ailes Hydrilicka. This man was heavily opposed to the idea of giant bones, and in the 1930s, he repeatedly published debunkings of the idea. He criticized human psychology, claiming people just want to believe. He claimed amateurs were the problems, that people digging up skeletons didn't know how to measure them properly, that they didn't know that the femur belonged in the socket, they didn't know that feet needed to be flat when you measured them, and you know, some of this stuff sounds ridiculous. Some of it you can understand to a degree, especially if you take into account that Ailes helped develop forensic anthropology. He helped the Fed solve some crimes. He also was a physician before he was a anthropologist. As a matter of fact, he has a pretty sinister reason for getting into the whole field of anthropology. I mean, he was really into anthropotometry. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong. I'll put the word on the screen. Now, if you aren't aware, anthropotometry is the systematic measurement of humans. All aspects are included: height, weight, limb proportions, all of it. And as you may be surprised as hell to hear, back in the 19th and 20th centuries, scientific racism was at its peak. The field of anthropometry was directly related to phrenology, the now debunked science where they measure the bumps on your head to determine what kind of attributes and characteristics you would have. And Ailes was a vocal white supremacist and very much believed that you could measure the bones of people and determine whether or not they were more likely to commit a crime or more likely to be stupid or more likely to be smart. And as he was a white supremacist, you can probably guess how these things landed in his measurements. As a matter of fact, this is why he moved into anthropology, is just specifically to push this racist narrative. And let me drive that home. He did not move into anthropology to, like, educate the world about the past. He moved into anthropology specifically to push the idea that the measurements of bones will inform you about the characteristics of the person you're measuring. Biological determinism, open fucking racism. But you know what? Don't take my word for it. Here's some mainstream science channel with a whole lot more followers than me talking about it.
Hrdlicka was one of many researchers attempting to use anthropometry to find physical differences between people of different races as a way of explaining assumed differences in intelligence, criminality, physical fitness, and more. And he was so passionate about this research that in 1895, Hrdlicka officially left medicine to become a physical anthropologist.
And this got him into accumulating massive collections of skeletal remains. Every institution and museum he worked at, he filled with bones of the deceased peoples. Exponentially more remains ended up in all these places, and he wound up as the head of the Smithsonian Institute's ethnology department. And in that role, he filled the place with bones even more. And he measured them all the time to prove that honkies were superior. And yeah, that was the whole point of him doing his thing. And he was so hard pressed to prove that natives were not as good as honkies that, well, he actually said that there was no way that anybody had made it to the Americas more than about 3,000 years before his time. And if you tried to argue with that and you were an archaeologist, he would crucify you and ruin your career. Sound familiar? Clovis, anybody? This was round one of the Clovis first type of thing. You can't posit anything without being kicked out by your colleagues and called a pseudoscientist. This man was given awards for this type of work that we now know was wrong. So the man that was in charge of the Smithsonian's Bureau of Ethnology, not an issue. His predecessors had published reports, numerous reports, of giant bones, of Native American giant bones. And how could the Native Americans be better than the whites, than the Europeans? So what did he do? He debunked this whole entire idea. He went and paraded a bunch of bones on a bunch of different... He went on a campaign, numerous speaking engagements, numerous letters, numerous publications, talking about how people didn't know any better. It was all wishful thinking. This was all bullshit. And at the end of the day, I can't trust this guy because I know he got into this just specifically to push a narrative that is directly tied to the size of bones. And so his debunking falls woefully short. When you look at the character of the four people I mentioned, he's worse than the drunk with the muddy boots on. I think we would all agree, right? I mean, this guy was horribly, horribly racist. By modern standards, even by his day standards, he had some colleagues of his that would call him out and be like, man, that is fucked up shit, bro. And the fact is, he was the curator of those remains. He had unfettered access to them all. If he wanted to sell some or hide some or lie about some, he could get rid of them, destroy them, however he wanted. He was the man in the position to do so. And unfortunately, he had a motive to do so. And what he ends up doing is the arguments that he levies, they ignore the fact that a lot of these measurements were not done by amateurs. They were done by valued field agents of the Smithsonian. And while some of them, well, certainly people are fallible, to accuse all of them or to assume all of them of being able to make that mistake, it's almost like leaning on, you have to lean on the fact that they were old people. They don't know any better than we do today. And it's kind of an insane little position, especially when you really look at what happened in 1959 at the Crescent Mound. Excavated in 1958 and 1959 by Dr. Don Dragoo, who was the curator of the section of man at the Carnegie Museum, it had numerous skeletons in it. The largest male found in subfloor tomb F-28 was exceptional in height. Measurements taken of the skeleton while still in the grave indicated an individual approximately 7 foot 2 inches tall. He would have been a splendid figure in any society and the darling of a primitive basketball team. Now, this was published in 1963 by a very talented, very respected, very modern archaeologist, right? And this was a problem for the people that were debunking this whole narrative of giants. Because, well, you'll notice that he didn't say, we measured the skeleton and it was 7 foot 2 inches. He says the measurements of it in the ground indicated that it was 7 foot 2 inches in height. In other words, he's using whatever the most modern formula or whatever it is to figure out the height of the skeleton. He's not a dummy. This isn't the new days. This is 1959, all right? So this is a big problem. And what do? Well, check out how archaeologist Olivia Jones debunks it. Dragoo was an archaeologist with the Carnegie Museum who excavated the Crescent Mound and many other Edina burial mounds. His 1963 book mentions the excavation of a 7 foot 2 inch high skeleton beneath the Crescent Mound, and this account is still used today as an example of supposedly giant Edina. Unfortunately, many readers are unaware that this is a field measurement, not a scientific reconstruction. Estimating an individual's living stature from skeletal remains requires well-preserved leg bones, as well as considerations in age and biological sex of the individual, Jones says. He didn't say the field measurement was 7'2". He said that it indicated the height of an individual that was 7'2". He was very clear about this. One has to wonder if Jones even read the damn paper at all. But the article continues. According to one of the curators at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History, the 7-foot measurement may even be a typo, as it cannot be found in Dragoo's original notes. Yes, the part where he said that this individual would be the darling of any primitive basketball team makes it very vague as to whether or not he was exceptionally tall. My dear God, it's like these people just make shit up. And if that's not bad enough, normally they don't even address things like this. If they do address it, they lie about it like this. But normally they just ignore the fact that the Smithsonian's ethnology reports reported on this stuff, the actual scientists reported on this stuff, and they just focus on newspaper articles and newspaper clippings, which, of course, I'm perfectly on board with the idea that the National Enquirer is not the first fucking newspaper to lie to its audience, all right? I'm quite certain numerous people throughout history have lied about the size of bones in order to sell newspapers. Which is why I'm so damn critical as to whose reports I'm willing to accept and whose debunkings I'm willing to accept. And so you have to wonder, why do they ignore their predecessors' work in favor of those old newspaper clippings? We see this in the YouTube debunkings just as well, and you can't help but wonder why it happens. Now, I don't think for a minute archaeologists are getting paid to lie about this. I think that mostly, well, the problem is that it looks like there was a quite possibly another species of hominid that was running around here, and that wouldn't work, especially in the days where evolution was just being accepted. But also, guys like Ailes were fucking racist, man. So the idea that there was a species that was possibly that was associated with the Native Americans that was possibly on par or superior to honkies was absolutely unacceptable and was going to quite possibly, by guys like Ailes, absolutely destroyed. All the evidence of that, he may well have literally destroyed. He took the job to drive a fucking narrative, man. I don't know how much clearer I can say it. I can't trust his debunkings at all. And we have real problems with this stuff. If you go look for these bones in the record, you can't fucking ever put your eyes on them. For example, even the one at the Carnegie Museum, which the one that was just found by Dr. Dragoo in 1959, that's said to be at the Carnegie Museum. It's never been displayed. It's never been remeasured. The measurements that are listed are 7'2". But can I go look at it? No. Tell me there's nothing up with that. It's the same as when I talk about the elongated skulls. At a certain point, fuck you, there's something going on here. For example, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA, forces museums to repatriate skeletal remains to indigenous tribes. But the Smithsonian is immune to NAGPRA, and other museums, like the Carnegie Museum, drag their feet so hard that at least half of the U.S. universities are still in violation of the law, which was passed in 1990. So there's a great possibility that a lot of these things are still hidden in museums, still hidden in private collections on rich people's shelves. That's probably where a huge number of them ended up, in all honesty, if they weren't outright destroyed by guys like Ailes. But one other thing I think is worth pointing out is the psychological thing where we look back in time, we're like, you know, those guys 100 years ago, they just didn't know what was up. They were kind of stupid, but the 1959 one doesn't sound so bad to me. It might sound bad to a lot of you younger people, though, because it is a long time ago. But, you know, my dad was born in 1950, so it's not that long ago. But I want to give you some food for thought. 100 years from now, people are going to look back on us with the same kind of thinking, right? That we weren't as smart as they are. And the Baghdad Battery was stolen in the early 2000s. There's a very good possibility that 100 years from now, they're going to think, yeah, these guys were stupid for ever believing such a thing existed. This was a hoax. This was a lie. And that's kind of fucked up. But when you think about it, I think a lot of you will follow exactly what I'm getting at there. But ultimately, what we have here is an issue where the debunkers have failed woefully. They can only assert people who were anything but ignorant, were stupid or ignorant, or outright ignore their words entirely in order to make their cases against the existence of larger bones in the record. You see, confirmation bias can cut both ways. You can want not to believe just as much as you can want to believe. Anybody who's had an ex cheat on them knows exactly what I'm talking about there. But the fact of the matter is, if you trust somebody who you know has biases, you're being gullible.
If we are not able to ask skeptical questions, to interrogate those who tell us that something is true, to be skeptical of those in authority, then we're up for grabs.
Well, thanks so much for watching. As you can see, I'm not home right now. I'm in Arizona again. And in just a day or two, I'm going to be headed to Austin to promote the next Quest for Ancient Civilizations conference. And this one is going to be a banger. We've got some new blood going to be there that is soon to be announced and is going to be fire. You're not going to have many more days to get the tickets, to get good seats anyway, as easily as you can right now. So if I was you, I would get on it if you've been kicking it around. If you haven't been kicking around, what the hell's wrong with you? And also, there's links to support the channel down below. And in early October, you're going to find me in Lake Chelan in Washington. I'll be up there with the Grammarica crew and Randall Carlson. I'm all over the damn place now. Thanks for supporting the channel, guys. There's links to do that down below, too. And you can even send me Fortnite skins or V-Bucks or Robux. I take that, too. But at any rate, thanks so much for watching. I hope you found this video informative, and I hope to see you next time.